Welcome back to the Better Know a Lawyer podcast. This week, I'm joined by Seattle Municipal Court Judge Ed McKenna. Judge McKenna is the head of the Mental Health Court in Seattle Municipal Court. It's an alternative court where they deal with defendants with mental health issues. We talk about how that court works compared to regular courts, resources, are the streets safe, and a lot of other things. Stay tuned.
Thanks for tuning in. Host Noah Weil is a licensed attorney admitted to practice in Washington State and the Federal Court of the Western District of Washington. Some guests on this program may be licensed attorneys as well. However, the discussion on this podcast is intended to be informative only and is not a substitute for legal advice for your particular situation. The information may be right or may be wrong. Changing laws and the laws of individual states mean the information presented here may not be accurate. But regardless, and this part is important, neither Noah nor any guest here is your lawyer. If you need a lawyer for your individual situation, you should consult and retain your own attorney.
This is Noah Weil, and I am joined by the Honorable Judge Edward McKenna of the Seattle Municipal Court. Good morning, Judge.
Good morning.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. I know you have a trial later today, so we won't keep you for too long, but I do appreciate you taking the time today to talk to us.
My pleasure.
Just can give the listener some background, your career arc, how long you've been a judge, that kind of thing.
Sure. I'm one of perhaps the few Seattle natives, born and raised in Seattle, schooled in Seattle, law school locally, was a prosecutor at the Seattle City Attorney's Office for just a little over 20 years, have been a judge in Seattle Municipal Court now for about 6 years. Many people don't realize prior to my prosecution experience, I did some defense work. So I do have a little bit of experience on both sides, and pretty much spent most of my career, at least the last 26 years, in primarily in Seattle Municipal Court.
I never encountered you as a prosecutor, but I know one of my first public defense stints was in your courtroom when you were just taking the bench.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought it was interesting for you to kind of get your sea legs and for me to get my sea legs. And we kind of like, I could see we were both learning over the course of that, and I thought that was really fun and helpful.
Well, I have to say, as a advocate and a prosecutor, it was a big learning curve jumping to a neutral position as a judge. A huge learning curve. As an attorney, I think it always looked, I always thought the judge's job looked easy. After having taken this job, I found out it's just the opposite.
Well, so it's a little off topic, but what caused you to seek the bench?
I think there was a number, a whole host of reasons. I thought, you know, after having been a prosecutor for so many years, I thought that I had the temperament, the skills, and the ability to be a judge. I wanted to make a difference in people's lives, as opposed to simply being a prosecutor and being an advocate. I looked at a judicial position as being an opportunity to make a significant contribution to public safety, as well as change individuals' lives the better. Hence, I think finding myself in a mental health court is a really a perfect fit for me. So I get to do, I went from having a great job to really my dream job, being in Seattle Municipal Court now.
So I do want to talk to you about mental health court, but I also kind of want to give the listeners the understanding of the difference between mental health court and a regular
sure.
criminal experience. So can you kind of just really briefly discuss the normal criminal case, like from arraignment to trial or resolution, how that works?
Sure, absolutely. Typical case involves police contacting an individual. They are either booked or released, and the prosecutor makes a charging decision either immediately if they're in custody or sometime in the future if they weren't booked. After that, an individual is arraigned either While in custody, we actually have a jail courtroom. In other words, a courtroom that's actually physically located in the jail building. Or individuals are sometimes brought to our main facility via a tunnel, which many people don't realize is actually a tunnel under that goes from the jail to our facility, making our facility very secure. Once those individuals are arraigned, they enter a plea of either guilty or not guilty. Typically, it would be a not guilty plea. And after that, there are typically defense attorneys raise a host of motions, negotiate with the prosecutors. Typically, cases end in pleas, and on a rare occasion, they will actually end up in trial. As opposed to a mental health, the mental health court is looked at completely different. Most officers now, I think probably all Seattle police officers now go through crisis intervention training to assist them in recognizing individuals who are experiencing a mental health crisis, when they will oftentimes now write in their reports that they are wishing individuals to be referred to the mental health court. At least it gives a flag, so to speak, for the prosecutor and the judge to recognize an individual is suffering from mental health issues. That individual is, if they end up in mental health court through various means, we treat individuals with serious mental health issues significantly differently, because we recognize that individuals who are suffering from mental disease or defect aren't necessarily in control of their abilities, and they should not otherwise suffer the same punishment as those who are making a voluntary or knowing or intelligent act to commit a crime, as opposed to individuals who simply can't help themselves.
So in the standard criminal case, the non-mental health court case, it's an adversarial process.
Exactly.
The prosecution and defense kind of throw legal arguments and factual issues at each other, and then the jury will make a decision, or a judge will make a decision, or they'll decide it's risky for both sides, let's make a deal for the law or for the equities. I understand mental health court's a little more collaborative.
And in that respect, it's completely opposite. It's a very collaborative process. As you mentioned, in the typical court, where you have an adversarial process, attorneys pitted against each other, and the judge is the neutral decision maker. In mental health court, everyone is working together to assist and benefit the defendant. It's a really interesting concept to see everyone actively working together to improve the lives of individuals who come into this court.
Do you know the number of cases that go to mental health court, or percentage-wise?
I don't know the specific percentage. There are many cases that are actually referred to mental health court that don't end up staying in mental health court. And that's because, for a whole host of reasons, individuals choose, they don't find that that's a good fit for them. There are individuals who may be experiencing a temporary drug-induced psychosis, and after a couple of days, they are no longer experiencing those major mental illnesses. And so individuals that come into the mental health court have to first have a primary diagnosis of a major mental health problem, as opposed to a substance abuse problem.
So I pulled this from the website of the court, and this is, their tagline. Let's see if it sounds right. The key issue for the mental health court is whether the alleged criminal activity is related to or caused by mental illness. Mental health court defendants may have any type of charge. They may have any type of serious mental illness, be developmentally disabled, have a brain injury, or suffer from dementia. The defendant may be a first-time offender or have a lengthy record. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. I don't think... At this point, there is no one that I have turned down for mental health court. There are some, perhaps many individuals that I have had concerns about, but for the most part, I have given just about everyone an opportunity to go through the mental health court. And there are, and I assume we'll probably get to this, but there are many benefits of going through the mental health court.
When you talk about concerns, can you elaborate on that as far as what the entry into the program is like and what could go wrong with that?
Yes. So when an individual enters mental health court, we have a mental health liaison that's actually paid by the court through the city pays the county to pay a mental health liaison to do an initial diagnosis to see if an individual is appropriate for mental health court.
So the city pays the county to pay this person?
Right.
Is
and
the
that
city
way,
engaging in money laundering?
No, the idea is that this individual is going to be able to provide a neutral and detached opinion as to whether this individual, whether the defendant is a good fit.
Okay.
So I think the county contracts with private organizations to provide a the court liaison, as we call them. Once that court liaison reviews the defendant, determines that they are. Potentially a good participant for our program. A release plan is then developed between the prosecution, the defense, the mental health providers, and individuals are then released on mental health conditions of release, which are significantly different than the typical conditions of release that you find in the mainstream courts.
So the mainstream courts, it could be bail, it could be abstain from alcohol, it could be a no-contact order. What's different in the mental health stuff?
Typically, we don't impose bail for conditions of release in mental health court if we impose mental health court conditions of release, because that typically requires individuals to make contacts with the court liaison to engage in mental health treatment, to take medications as prescribed, and a whole host of other requirements that are typical for individuals that are suffering from a major mental illness.
I've done some cases in mental health court, not many, but some, and there's been some changes over the years too in how it's run, but I recall that people with crimes of aggression and violence
mm-hmm.
had a harder time getting into mental health court than those of like trespassing or shoplifting or things like that, or property-based crimes.
Well, I think it depends on the judge. Like I say, I have never turned anyone down. There are some individuals that, again, I would be concerned about because they potentially pose a significant public safety risk if released. And so the conditions that I may place on them might be a little more stringent. I'll give an example of an individual who may have maybe a domestic violence offender and a repeat domestic violence offender with a history of violence. I may release that individual to seek mental health treatment, but I will place a GPS monitor on that individual. I think I've only done that once, maybe twice. Pretty rare. But for individuals that I have serious concerns about, they're not going to have a lot of opportunities. So typically we find in mental health court, individuals have extreme difficulties oftentimes in complying with the court's conditions. We anticipate that individuals will have difficulties in complying. But again, there are some that I will have some serious concerns about if they don't follow the conditions. Then they will be what we call opted out. In other words, excluded and sent back to a mainstream court.
So is a concern that in a mainstream court, they might have a heavy bail imposed because of their criminal history and because of the nature of the charges, but in mental health court, they would be released, essentially, even if under pretty strong court supervision.
Correct.
And they could theoretically commit more crimes.
Correct.
I guess I will ask you, is the risk worth it? I mean, you have a big net where a lot of people can get mental health services, but in the course of that, some people that should be kept away from society are released.
Well, and I think that's always a concern that a judge has every case that you look at. In determining release, you have to consider whether this individual is likely to commit another violent offense or fail to appear. For individuals experiencing mental health, they are probably likely to fail to appear at a higher rate, perhaps engage in more criminal activity unless otherwise treated, whether the risk is worth it. I think as a society, I think we all recognize that it's simply inherently unfair to house an individual in custody because of their mental health. We're simply treating them differently for things that perhaps may be beyond their control or with medications they would be otherwise able to control. And so I think we all recognize that we would all like to see individuals obtain mental health treatment so that it reduces their contacts with the police in the future, reduces jail costs, reduces the likelihood that they will reoffend in the future, reduces victimization. And so I think when you ask, is it really worth it? Yeah, there's always a risk to the judge that my face may end up on the front page of the paper tomorrow, but that's what we're paid to do. And every case is a risk, and you know, we have to evaluate those, and I always try to think of how I can benefit the defendant in my release conditions in mental health court.
It's funny you mentioned the newspaper. Maybe you've seen this article. Judge Kessler a few years ago released somebody charged with a felony, and mm-hmm. you know, he did the analysis to determine this person should be released on their own promise to appear, and the person went out and, you know, did some horrible crimes, and it got back to the Times that Judge Kessler could have imposed bail or whatever, and he didn't. And Judge Kessler was unapologetic. He said, I have a job to do. I weigh the bail and the conditions of release and everything else, and this was my determination. And sometimes it doesn't work out, but the other way to do it is just lock everybody up when they're accused of any crime. It's because of the potential mm-hmm. They commit a crime. And he was, and you know, people are saying he should be impeached and thrown out of office and all the rest of it. But he was completely right, and I agree with you too, that you make these choices, you make these balancing acts, and ultimately, you know, you do the best with the information you have available, but some people should be released and some people should be in treatment.
Sure.
I've had many clients where they needed services, they didn't really get services, especially in the jail, and they went out and committed more crimes when they got out, and mm-hmm. that's just the cycle. It doesn't help anybody. It's like people, they should be locked up. Well, we don't lock people up for life in Seattle Municipal Court, so they're going to get out eventually, and then what?
Well, you know, really, that's it. In Seattle Municipal Court, we have a maximum jurisdiction, in other words, a maximum penalty of a year in jail on for each offense. So in some cases, those can be run consecutively, but the reality is people are going to be released at some point. And if you are able to provide treatment, whether it's substance abuse, whether it's mental health treatment, to address the underlying issues, you know, individuals or otherwise, when they're released, they're going to commit another crime. And if you can treat their substance abuse disorder, their mental health disorder, it is far likely that those individuals will engage in additional criminal activity. They will hopefully become productive members of society, and reduce costs, jail costs, and victimization overall. So it's really, I think, in everyone's best interest to see individuals obtain treatment for whatever their issue is, because they are going to be released at some point.
Now, you mentioned substance abuse and also voluntary acts as far as mental health affecting the voluntariness of their acts. How much does substance abuse fit into all this?
It seems that the last few years, substance abuse, at least the types of offenses that we see, it seems like a majority of our cases now involve substance abuse. A lot of methamphetamine seems to be popular. Heroin and addictions seems to be significant. And of course, alcoholism and alcohol-related offenses has always been fairly common, but it seems that we are seeing far more drug-related offenses now. That's just, I don't have specific evidence of that, but that's just simply from my own observation.
And what do you think about the comorbidity of substance abuse and mental health issues?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that we see quite frequently in mental health court is individuals that are suffering from a dual diagnosis. In other words, they have substance abuse and mental health issues, and you can't treat one without the other. We don't, at least at this point, have a drug court in Seattle Municipal Court, but in mental health court, you know, we can't take everyone. And so what we do is we will take individuals whose primary diagnosis is mental health, and if they have a secondary diagnosis of substance, we take individuals with mental health as a primary, and if they have a secondary diagnosis of substance abuse, we will treat or seek to treat that as well. So, but we can't, at least at this point, simply take individuals in mental health court that have a substance abuse disorder as their primary diagnosis.
Do you think that's a flaw in the system and the resources, or are you happy that mental health and substance abuse are partitioned a little bit, or at least that mental health is the primary focus?
Well, I would like to see, you know, of course, if we had the resources available to do what we would really like to do, we would have it.
I'm going to interrupt you and say you're not the first judge I've done on this podcast, and resources is a popular topic with a lot of people.
Resources are always an issue. You know, time limitations, we don't have, you know, the judges to just simply implement the number of specialty courts that we would like to have. We're always talking in court about how we can change our specialty courts. But I would like to see us have the ability to treat individuals with substance abuse as a primary disorder in some type of specialty court.
I think that's actually interesting you bring all this up. I know you have a veterans court, you have a mental health court. Are there other specialty courts? There's community courts.
And domestic violence court.
Oh, is there a domestic violence court? Is it a specialty court?
Right. Well, and we consider that as a specialty court because our judges all go through special training, and enhanced training to recognize issues that are specific to domestic violence issues.
So you're in kind of a unique position to talk about this, but I know there's a lot of narrative in the general public that crime is up and people are less safe and you know, more people are being charged and they should be charged and all that rest of it. And I kind of think, as our understanding of how the human brain works and treatment and all the rest of it, that the actual, like, scary stuff, the sociopath, the voluntary person who's doing crimes, is not as much as people think it is. And there's a lot of substance abuse and there is a lot of mental health things. But as far as, like, the dangerousness of people intrinsically versus some diagnosis, it's not as much as people think. And I think, you know, the media maybe has whipped up a little bit of a frenzy on that. But I'm curious what your thoughts are on
that. That's an interesting issue. Of course, most of the cases that we see that involve crimes of violence seem to be a substance abuse-related offense. Methamphetamines, for instance, seems to be a huge motivating factor in crimes of violence. And in criminal activity overall, we see so many shoplifts and property crimes resulting from individuals fueling their addictions. So, but the actual violent offenses, at least the major violent offenses, I don't typically see, you know, the extremely serious types of offenses because those would go to an otherwise other court. But assaults and things of that nature, I haven't, just from my own observations, and I don't have information on this, I haven't seen a significant increase overall, except those related to substance abuse offenses.
Do you think that, we'll say society, we can talk about Seattle specifically, mm-hmm. Do you think society is dropping the ball with people who need these services sooner? I mean, once they come to you, something's already gone wrong. Is there a way that we can apply resources so they don't, you never see them in the first place?
Well, yes, and I think, you know, resources are always an issue. If there were unlimited resources to treat individuals with addictions and mental health disorders, we would probably see far less criminal activity. And getting into, of course, you know, legalization of drugs or providing, you know, alternative methods of addressing individuals with serious addictions are perhaps beyond my, I'm not sure I really want to get into that portion, but clearly as a society as a whole, we need to look at other ways of addressing addictions so that individuals don't end up in court. They build criminal histories, which impacts their ability to become productive because they're going to be prohibited from obtaining good jobs, housing, and they will simply end up in the continuous cycle of committing crimes because they can't get a good job, they can't get housing, and we see that over and over and over.
I think that, and I guess I'm curious about your opinion because maybe I'm kind of an echo chamber, but I think that societally speaking, mental health used to have a huge stigma. Going to a therapist or getting treatment was seen as a sign of weakness, especially for men. You know, depression is very common among men, and you sucked it up. PTSD was just like, oh, that's something that happens to veterans, but right. It's not something you should be treated because that's weak. And I think there's a bit of a sea change now where people are recognizing that it's not a weakness to get help, especially if you have some kind of mental health problem. But maybe people should be encouraged more so. Maybe there's something that can be done earlier in the stages. I don't know. But I know I've talked to clients who went through long stretches of their life. Some were veterans, some were not. They had to fend for themselves. And no one told them to get help, and they never sought help on their own. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I guess, and I think you're correct. There seems to be a stigma associated with mental health issues. And even those individuals coming through the court, we see that all the time because, you know, for an example is when competency is raised by an attorney, I'm always reluctant to use the term competency as opposed to the RCW code 1077, because once you mention competency, individuals take serious offense to that. But if you mention 1077, they won't necessarily know what that means, and it doesn't have the same stigma, at least for the defendant. I think there are many individuals that are reluctant to go through our court because they don't want to have that stigma of having to go through mental health court. And as a society, I think perhaps the stigma is lessening because I think we all know people that are suffering some form of mental health and being treated by typical drugs or medications. When individuals seek psychiatric or psychological assistance, it's pretty common now, and I think everybody knows someone that's usually on medications.
Hopefully. I mean, there's talk about over-medicating versus, you know, cognitive therapy.
Sure.
I think it really depends on the places you go, the way you interact. I'm sure there's some pockets of civilization that's still not done, period.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I hope it's changing. I think it's great. Now, another difference between mental health court and mainstream court is that to enter mental health court, you kind of have to waive your rights, right? You may have to plead guilty to something or enter a disposition or something where if the treatment doesn't work out, you don't get to go to trial and confront all your witnesses.
Typically, and, you know, and that's kind of the... There's benefits and detriments of going through mental health court. If you are going to what we call opt-in to mental health court, and that's seek treatment and be under the supervision, frequent reviews, et cetera, of mental health court, the prosecution will offer some form of disposition. So in other words, either plead guilty to the offense and be on probation, or enter into some form of pretrial disposition, in other words, a stipulated order of continuance or dispositional continuance, as we call them. In other words, continuing the trial on condition that you do mental health conditions, and if you're successful, the prosecution will dismiss the charge. In either case, the sentencing recommendation will usually be lenient. And the conditions will be lenient, but they will include the mental health court conditions of sentence. So typically it's obtained a substance, mental health evaluation, substance abuse evaluation, abstain, not possess weapons, not threaten other individuals, and engage in treatment, take your medications as prescribed. One of the big holdbacks from that, the big benefit is if you violate the conditions, typically the sanctions are significantly less than you would expect in a mainstream court. And
in a mainstream court, if you violate your dispositional continuance, you could be found guilty.
Because everyone works together in mental health court, the prosecution will oftentimes agree, and perhaps usually agree, to not revoke the dispositional continuance and ask the court to enter a finding on condition the defendant, you know, the parties might agree to some other minor sanctions to assure that the defendant will then otherwise comply with the conditions they had initially agreed upon.
So, you know, from a defense attorney's position, it's sometimes tough because you might have a case with some real legal issues, mm-hmm. or the person could say, I'm innocent. It happens.
Sure.
But they could also need mental health services and should be in mental health court. And so balancing from a defense perspective, and I'm curious from a judicial perspective, what do you think about this, but balancing giving up, you know, your constitutional rights versus getting a person the treatment they need as quickly as possible can be challenging.
I think it places a defense counsel in a very difficult position, requiring you to have a pretty long and lengthy discussion with your client as to whether mental health court is going to be a good fit. We recognize that individuals who are successful in going through mental health court are far less likely to engage with the police in the future, far less likely to engage in a future criminal activity. And, you know, there's always those potential defenses. You can opt out and go through the mainstream court, take your risks at trial, even plead guilty there. But recognizing if you violate the conditions, the sanctions are likely to be more severe than they are if you go through mental health court. So in mental health court, we try to offer both the carrot and the stick. We offer encouragement. We offer, some rewards for individuals that do good. The sanctions are less because we want to encourage individuals to complete the program. Whereas if you're in the mainstream court, if you violate the conditions, the sanctions are usually going to be very strict and there are not a whole lot of positive rewards. But from a defense counsel's perspective, if you're looking at the overall best interest of your client and reducing recidivism and lessening the likelihood that they're going to contact police in the future or obtain additional criminal convictions that may have significant detrimental impacts to them, it's certainly something that you need to weigh and talk to your client about.
I wish the person could try the mental health services and see how well they do, and if it doesn't work out, they can go back to mainstream court and take their chances there.
But surprisingly, we actually offer that opportunity. We give individuals an opportunity to try out mental health court to see if it's going to be a good fit for them.
Okay.
And if everyone is in agreement with that, we let people try it out for a little while. We'll put them on mental health conditions of release. They get to do their treatment, maintain their medications, maintain sobriety, and if they find that it's going to be a good fit for them, then they can opt into the court and they can accept the prosecutor's or work with the prosecutor to negotiate a disposition, allowing them to opt into our court. But we oftentimes find people that are trying it out to see if it's a good fit for them.
That's good. You know? I think it's a recent change because it wasn't when I was doing it.
We, and oftentimes people find that mental health court just isn't a good fit for them for whatever reason. The detriment is they're going to be on conditions, the mental health court conditions for typically a rather lengthy time. They may have to plead guilty. They're going to have to abstain from alcohol and drugs. And sometimes people are just willing to take their risk in a mainstream court as opposed to doing those things. We have what we call an opt-in meeting between the court, prosecutor, defense, probation, and we bring everyone to the table and we talk about how we can, you know, the conditions of opting in are the optimal conditions. So right now we're working with the prosecution to adjust their recommendations. For instance, instead of requiring a full 2 years of jurisdiction, give credit for individuals who gave it a try. In other words, a trial run, and let's say they were on mental health court conditions for 2 months or 3 months, give them credit for that. So they may have a 20-month dispositional continuance or an 18-month dispositional continuance as opposed to a 24-month dispositional continuance. And so we're working with the prosecutor, working with defense to see if we can all come up with ways to provide, I guess, the optimum incentives and sanctions for individuals who might otherwise want to try out our court.
Well, I definitely appreciate you guys tweaking and looking at things and making decisions going forward about what's working best, so kudos to that. I'm going to give you a compliment now, so prepare yourself for the compliment.
It doesn't happen very often.
Here it comes. I've been in front of a bunch of judges, and I find that you personally, your style, has a really solid blend of giving the defendant, or even the lawyers, but especially the defendant, a chance to be heard and speak, while also maintaining a sense of control in the courtroom. Some judges err one too far one way or the other, as you can imagine. I won't name names, but and I didn't realize that it was such a virtue until I started going to more courtrooms and more courthouses and seeing how courts control their own courtrooms, how judges control their own courtrooms. And I'm curious, especially for mental health court, where you have situations where people may start going off on tangents, start getting very angry, focus on things that aren't important or relevant or legal, how you balance that, their need to be heard and their right to be heard versus maintaining control of the courtroom and keeping things moving.
Well, first of all, thank you for the compliment. It's much appreciated. I'm a firm believer in procedural justice. And if individuals, whether it's defense or the defendants, believe that they have been adequately heard, the judge has considered everything that they have to say, they are going to have a greater confidence in our legal system as a whole, and defendants are more likely to comply with the court's conditions. And I think it's even more important in our mental health court, where we provide encouragement to individuals who go through our court, because some of our studies have shown that procedural justice is one of the primary motivating factors for individuals to comply. When defendants come into my court, I will take notes. For instance, I'll be talking with the defendant, and he'll tell me that he works at a factory building metal fences, for instance, and I'll make note of that. So the next time that person comes before me for review, I'll ask him how his job at the metal fence building company is going, and it shocks, I think, a lot of defendants, because they think, oh, the judge recognizes me, and he's taken a personal interest in my case. Mm-hmm. And probation subsequently will tell me, oh, Mr. Defendant was in the other day, and he really was telling me how he wanted to comply because he didn't want to disappoint Judge McKenna. And I think that's great if I can encourage individuals, take a personal interest in their case, which oftentimes I do. And I actually sincerely take a personal interest in their cases. But I think they are far more likely to comply with the conditions, and we are less likely to see them back in the future. But everybody wants to be heard, and it goes for defense attorneys as well. And I think it's sometimes we're restricted by time requirements, but I try to give individuals enough time to address the court as they need to. For individuals that are suffering mental health problems, that's not always the case. But I think it's sometimes, as a judge, it's difficult to be calm on the bench. We're all human, and it can be challenging and trying at times in mental health court. But
did you see that transcript from Georgia?
No.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh, I'm going to send it to you afterwards.
It was
a judge losing his temper with a squirrely defendant. It didn't look good for the system at all.
It can be trying at times. And I think there's only once that I've held an individual in contempt in mental health court, and that was only after the person was found to be competent. But it's frequently, I think another judge sat in mental health court this week for me, and was commenting, had never sat in mental health court before, and was commenting to me how difficult it was when you have a defendant yelling at you, calling you all kinds of names, and how difficult it is to not take action against that individual. You know, and so being in mental health court can be trying at times, and hopefully I have a good fit and personality for that court. At least I've been told that I'm a good fit for that court. I'm not sure what that necessarily means, though.
Depends who's telling you, I guess.
Exactly.
You said in the beginning that you got into this profession to help people, and you felt comfortable that mental health court was a good fit for you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still feel that way? Do you feel like you are making a difference?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's not very often that, well, and I thank you for the compliment today, but it's not otherwise often that that judges are receive thanks from individuals, but time after time in mental health court, individuals, defendants who go through our court will tell me how appreciative they are of the fact that they had the opportunity, that there was this court available for them, because they don't know what would have happened otherwise had they gone through the mainstream court. And it's really satisfying as a judge to know that you've made a positive impact on individuals. And in mental, and I guess I get that positive reinforcement to try to continue doing a good job in that court because of the thanks I get from defendants who oftentimes go through that court. So I'm convinced that I'm making a difference in many people's lives, and based upon the positive feedback that they provide me.
I wish in our system that prosecutors and defense attorneys could meet with judges after cases and like kind of debrief and talk about stuff we like, stuff we didn't like.
Right.
It doesn't work. I mean, you're always in front of the judge. There's always going to be future cases.
Well, there's always appellate issues too. That you know, there's the potential that the case could come back, and so I would like also to meet, you know, and debrief about a case when we've had those, and I wish there were a better opportunity to do that when it's fresh in everybody's mind.
I will say, just for procedural justice, and I've told the story before, but I'll repeat it again for you because I'm sure you're not a listener to the podcast, because no one listens to this podcast. Just as a heads up, no one's going to listen to this whatsoever. I've had a couple trials where I've lost, and I'm a competitive person. I don't like losing under any circumstance. Mm-hmm. And the case was garbage. There's no chance of winning, whatever, but they wanted to go forward, or the deal was no good. But, you know, I tried my best, cross-examined strongly, made my motions, made my objections. And afterwards, you know, I tell the client, I'm sorry we lost, you know, and they're like, no, you gave me my day in court, you were clearly fighting, they played fair, you played fair, and this is how it should go. And they were just so sanguine about the whole thing because they had felt procedurally that it was a fair process, and they had lost after the jury fully and fairly considered all the evidence and the lawyers were on the ball. And that to me was a revelation, that was what they were looking for, not a win necessarily, but just that the process seemed fair as it applied to them.
Well, you know, and I think when individuals, defendants, feel that they had their day in court, the judge and the jury fully and fairly considered their arguments, if the court rules against them for a particular reason, they appreciate the judge's making an informed decision, and really so long as they had their day and they felt that they were adequately heard, win or lose, I think people are satisfied with the process. And I think,
I mean, there's some exceptions.
Oh, sure, there's always an exception. I always appreciate it when, you know, defense attorneys tell their clients, you know, hey, we did the best we could. You know, I understand the judge's position. I may not agree with it, but, you know, as opposed to saying, oh, that judge is clearly wrong.
I'll tell you, in my experience, the ones that are most understanding and appreciative of that procedural justice are indigent people who may have societally been neglected. Versus sometimes my private clients are a little more entitled and, you know, they feel like they deserve to win no matter what.
Right. Well, they think they're paying for you to win.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have conversations about that. But it's in my fee agreement. There's no guarantees here.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I think that it is nice that it's an opportunity for people who may have been marginalized by minorities or by income to have an opportunity where they get their day in court and they're treated as if they were a rich person or a corporation or anything else, and the jury listens to them. And I do feel like that's important. And that I appreciate judges, you, et cetera, are active in that opportunity.
Well, you know, and I think it's important that everyone receives that procedural justice, and whether a person is paying for the defense or it's an indigent defendant who is receiving the services of a public defender, if individuals feel that they've had their day in court, they've been adequately heard, and if a court rules or court or judge or jury rules against them, I think they're more likely to comply with the conditions if they felt that they had their a fair day in court.
So this is the last thing. I know you have to get going. My parents were visiting, I think, around Thanksgiving time last year, and I had a hearing in Kent, which is close to the airport. And the way their time worked out, I said, why don't you come with me to the court and you can watch me do my hearing, and then I'll take you to, you know, the airport so you can go home. And it turned out at that hearing that I had to raise competency. It was a felony arraignment that I had to raise competency off the bat. And so there was a lot of back and forth and talking about that and procedural stuff. And they watched it, and they're not lawyers, so we talked about it along the way, and they talked about what the standard for competency is and my role and the judge's role and all that. And I thought it was an interesting discussion. Like, they don't see me work that often, and it was an unusual case anyway. But I think that the public in general maybe isn't aware that they can come to watch court proceedings anytime they want, and they can see how this process works in real time.
You know, I encourage people to come to our court and watch, I think many people, the only exposure they have to a courtroom is watching TV judges, which is really not reality. And so I encourage people to know, I mean, we're funded by taxpayer money. You know, we're open and accountable to the public. The public should know what we do and how the system works, what they're getting for their taxpayer dollars. I like to see people come into my court. If I have an opportunity, I will oftentimes even meet with people. You know, there are many schools that will bring their classes to court because people are really never exposed to the court. People are reluctant to actually open that courthouse door because they don't know what's inside. And there's this, I guess, stigma of a gruff judge that might be inside that door. But I encourage people to come and watch our courts. We're all open to the public. There are many educational opportunities that I think people miss. And they could gain a far greater exposure to our system and understanding of the law if they just come down and watch.
Now, if someone's cell phone goes off in the middle of a hearing, obviously they are going to jail for the week.
I might have my bailiff confiscate their phone. We all have our pet peeves. Cell phones, gum chewing, hats. Those are some of my pet peeves.
We all have some pet peeves, except you have all of them. Okay. When does mental health court meet?
Mental health court is Monday through Thursday, starting at 1:30 p.m. And we have what we call the must-dos on Friday morning. So in other words, if we have competency returns on Friday mornings at 10 or 10:30. But that's if someone wants to actually observe mental health court, I would suggest Monday through Thursday at 1:30.
Maybe you'll see some new faces in the crowd.
I hope. And for practitioners, I know it's kind of it's an entirely different system. I encourage you to come down and speak with the attorneys who routinely practice in that court. We have dedicated attorneys and the prosecutor who, you know, can provide, I guess, the lay of the land and talk to you about whether mental health court might be a good fit for your client. So I encourage people to come down and talk with all the attorneys.
Do you think the Seattle Municipal Court model is a good model for other courts of limited jurisdiction?
I recently attended a mental health court summit, and we are, at least what I saw, above and beyond what most mental health courts are doing. We have such a great system, and we have a system that's even greater than or better than most. Because we incorporate not only the typical mental health court model, but anytime competency is raised, for instance, the competency return will be addressed in the mental health court. And because individuals have, whether it's defense attorneys, the judges, the probation counselors, have a better understanding of the competency issues, we can recognize and potentially encourage individuals to go through the mental health court if they are found to be competent in that court.
And just so we all know, competency is such a severe mental health issue that they can't understand the nature of the proceedings or assist in their own defense.
Correct.
Okay. Just so the listeners understand.
Right.
It's a pretty high standard.
It is a high standard.
It's more than just anxiety or schizophrenia or any other single diagnosis. It has to be a severe...
Individuals have to suffer from a significant mental disease or defect to be unable to assist their attorney in their defense or understand the nature of the proceedings. But I mean, that happens pretty frequently, and unfortunately, those individuals who are found to be not competent are, for the most part, simply released back to the streets. There's really not a good system to deal with individuals who are not competent and who are likely to be high utilizers of the justice system, whether it's contacts with the police.
The felony system is a little different.
The felony system is a little bit different. It's very difficult to restore competency can sometimes be restored for some individuals through the use of medications, but the time that's allowed by statute to restore competency in a misdemeanor case makes it highly unlikely, rarely if ever, is there enough time to restore competency.
Yeah. Well, I am happy that mental health court is going well and that you feel you're making a difference. I'm sure you are. And that you are able to share your findings with other courts and get them maybe moving in the right direction.
We were able to share some of our experiences with some other courts and other jurisdictions at the recent mental health court summit. Seattle Municipal Court was the first municipal court, mental health court in the nation. And there are, since then, 20-some years ago, there are a lot of mental health courts all over the country making significant differences in people's lives. So I'm really proud to be part of our court and the mental health court as a whole.
All right. Well, that's all the questions I have for today, Judge. Thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your thoughts on this subject with us.
My pleasure.
This is Noah Weil for the Better Know a Lawyer podcast, signing off.